Hello, and welcome to the Field Guides. I'm Steve, and I'm actually alone in my garage re-recording the intro because of a glitch while we were recording. So I'm just going to say what you guys would have heard if it weren't for the glitch. So I'm here with some guy named Bill, but also Daniel, the true MVP of the podcast for the last year. And if it were for him, we probably wouldn't have gotten out half the episodes that we got out. So a special shout out to Daniel. He's really an amazing addition to the team. And I just wanted to make sure I get that shout out. But now let's cut back to the regular opening and you'll hear the glitch. And I hope you enjoy the episode. For the last year and some
good.
So what we're going to do today and over the course of many future episodes is give you the experience of what it's like to be out in the field, in the woods, and on the trail. For every episode, we pick a natural history topic, research the science on that topic, head out to a natural area, and share with you everything that we've learned.
And today, it's a special episode because for the first time in a very long time, we have a Steve research episode. I can't wait because Daniel and I have no idea what Steve is going to talk about today, but Daniel did say before we turned on the mic, I bet it's going to be really sciencey.
Something that's probably difficult for me to understand, I expect. So
honestly, I'm hoping not. I think maybe it'll go over Bill, but I'm hoping not over Daniel. So,
and we also want to let the listeners know that we have an announcement about Daniel, good and bad, but we're going to leave you with a little cliffhanger. We're going to talk about that at the end of the episode today.
All right.
All right. Yeah. All right, Steve. What are we talking about today?
Yeah, and you can't skip ahead either. You have to listen to the whole episode to find out. All right, so as you guys said, you don't actually know what the topic of the episode is, but I'll give you a hint. So, Daniel, what have you always said was your favorite species of fish? But don't say it out loud. We'll say it on the count of three because everyone knows. We all know.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, ready? Okay. 3, 2, 1.
Salmon. Carp.
Okay, so
not even
see, I made this episode especially for Daniel, but I guess I messed up. So for listeners, I plan on talking about the grass carp's biology.
Oh,
its introduction to the Great Lakes region, why people are concerned about it, and then also anything I found interesting about it.
That's awesome.
So if you're expecting to find out, like, hey, when does it breed? You know, like, really typical information that you would always have. I kind of forgot to look some of that up, but...
How dare you? Another fish episode?
Yeah. See, this is why I thought hopefully Daniel might know something about it. And I think Bill doesn't know anything about fish.
I should have picked up on that. I definitely know nothing about
fish. I've had
some
really cool encounters with grass carp.
And I want to hear them this episode. Yeah.
All right. And before Steve continues, folks, we just got to let you know, we might be picking up a little wind today. We are recording this in late February 2025. We are at the tail end of an extremely long winter here in Western New York. We have not seen the grass for well over, 6 weeks?
Oh, yeah.
It's been a while.
Something like that. And this is actually the first day. Steve picked a beautiful day. It's the first day over 40, and I don't know how long.
Wow.
But we do have some wind moving through here. So we are at J.P. Nicely Park. Which I don't know if we've ever recorded here before, have we?
We have. I know we must have.
I thought about that, and I was like, they probably had to have, but I couldn't think of an episode off the top of my head.
So this park, it's right around the corner from my house, so it's super convenient for me. But it's a town park, relatively small. I don't even know how many acres are here. Maybe, 60? 100?
Probably just under 100, I would think.
Some beautiful patches of old growth in here, mostly second growth forest, but an amazing... little patch of forest for a town park.
It's a hidden gem.
Yeah, it really is beautiful.
By the way, it's like the windiest day in the world right now, but we're like down in a nice ravine hiding from it. So nice
we have
waterfall.
A beautiful slate bottom creek to run through here, West Branch of Cazenovia Creek. And I can't believe we haven't recorded more episodes here.
I know.
So I honestly think I hardly ever want to record here because I feel selfish because it's so close to my house. Uh-huh.
And because with Earth Spirit, we operate here like for every program.
So that's the environmental ed organization Daniel's been working for that I worked for long ago. But Steve, take it away. Let's talk about grass carp.
Yeah, so I want to mention right off the bat that there are actually 4 Asian carps that people are concerned about in the Great Lakes region and beyond. So you have grass carp, big head, silver, and black carp.
What about common carp? Is that one? Or is it just
kind of
naturalized
at this point? I don't
think people
are really concerned
about it. Yeah. Okay, yeah, no, I get it, because they're just kind of like all over the place now. I think they're just considered, you know, naturalized at this point.
I will say, during the field season, we see common carp a lot, and we even shock them up, but, like, we're not concerned. We're not catching them. There's no research that I'm aware of with common carp.
Gotcha.
So, Daniel, you use that term naturalized. Let the audience, what does that mean?
Sure. So naturalized refers to a species that is not from around here. It's not native to the area, and it makes its way over, and it just kind of asserts itself into the food web, and it may cause some issues. It is still considered an invasive species, so you're kind of getting into the semantics there, but it's in the food web. It's been here for a while. It's not something that people are really actively trying to remove. You kind of think like dandelions, right? They're all over the place now, but they're not from around here. They're a part of the system here out in our open field environments, so yeah, they're just kind of a part of it now, and they're not from here. And they may cause some negative consequences like the common carp still does.
So I'll have to look into that and put in the episode notes, because I've always taught people, and God, maybe I'm wrong, that the difference between a naturalized exotic and an invasive exotic is that invasives tend to form monocultures, pure stands of themselves.
Okay.
Whereas naturalized ones can live alongside, usually, other native species.
Okay. Yeah, this one is definitely more considered invasive. I just, you know, I said kind of naturalized because I think it's just to a point now where it's been here for a while, and, you know, they're fairly ubiquitous around the area, and they're not like, they do cause ecological consequences, but not to nearly the same degree as what people fear about the other one Steve just mentioned. So people aren't like actively trying to terminate them in mass quantities like they might with the other kinds.
Now, I'm new to being a fish guy, so for all I know, people could be concerned about it. I just don't know about that.
Yeah.
You know, and we see them all the time, and it hasn't come up. So, yeah.
Let's turn to the left so the wind is at our backs.
Okay.
Okay. That's better.
Okay, and I kind of want to also just get this out of the way. If you've seen those videos of people boating through a relentless onslaught of carp jumping out of the water and even injuring people sometimes, those are actually silver carp, and I guess also bighead carp are also known to jump out of the water, but less frequently.
Daniel is vigorously nodding.
So silver carp are really sensitive and go wild when they're spooked. And all this is to say, having silver carp really being the only one that jumps out of the water like this, that the jumping isn't really the fear. That's really not why people don't like these fish. It's really their diets and their extreme high fecundity or reproductive success that will quickly outpace native species. So those are more along the lines of why people don't like them. The jumping out of the water and potentially injuring people, that's just like a side thing.
Dude, I saw this video of a guy, I think it is in areas around the Mississippi River and places around there. This guy was water skiing. He had a football helmet on, and in front of the water ski, there was like somehow a basketball hoop like attached to the whole rig. So he's literally water skiing with the net and catching the silver carp from the air with his net and just dunking them in the basketball hoop while he's water skiing.
We're going to have to look that up. Wow.
I saw the video. It's true.
Yeah.
This is before all the AI stuff.
Are you going to talk about, like, description, what they look like?
Okay. Yeah.
Because
I said I wasn't going to say they're, like, breeding and stuff, but, like, I'll give you some stuff, you know? And as always, I will be using this fish to review some important topics in biology that I think the audience should be aware of, whether or not Bill and Daniel agree with me, but I will. And actually, this fish actually means a lot to me because I've been the one secretly releasing them into Lake Erie as a prank.
Dang. So, yeah. It's you. Just like how the DEC is releasing mountain cougars in Western New York.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. But I actually do some research on grass carp, and I just kind of wanted to brush up on some of the literature anyway, especially the literature that I'm not really, like, directly involved with, just to get a better sense of the species. Because I primarily do research on plant and animal genome evolution, but I think it's always important to have some kind of understanding of the species itself, even if, you know, you're mostly running analyses on A's, T's, C's, and G's, their DNA, you know. You need to have some kind of ecological context to really understand what you're working on. All right, so first let's describe what it looks like Bill was hoping I was going to do.
Now, I'm going to reveal my stupidity
here.
Because in my head, I'm like, you should ask this question. I'm like, no, I don't want to sound stupid.
Yeah.
So when I hear that word carp, isn't a goldfish a carp?
They're in the same family.
Yeah.
The middle family.
All right.
Yeah.
Yep. No, you're good. Right. Yeah. Okay, so the grass carp is a silvery to olive fish. There's a darkening on the back of the scale, so its body has this nice crosshatch pattern. It's elongated, chubby, torpedo-shaped, you know, like a fish you would draw as a child. Who gives a fuck, right? It looks like a fish. I don't know. Like, I don't know.
It was hard to describe, you know?
We're 9 minutes in, and Steve's dropped 2 F-bombs already.
Oh, my God. Bad week.
This
huh?
is what happens when, you know, when you're under pressure. Right. So it can get pretty big. I read that adults can be almost 4 feet long and over 40 pounds, with some in Asia reported to live over 21 years and reach sizes of 5 feet and weigh 100
Whoa.
Pounds.
Yeah.
Holy yeah. Crap. So it's pretty similar looking to the common carp that we just talked about. But the common carp's dorsal fin extends all the way down its back, kind of like a mohawk, while the grass carp's fin is much shorter. It just sort of comes out of one, not like one spot, but just a little section. Okay. Yeah. So in a sense, it really doesn't matter what it looks like. These guys are primarily herbivorous and consume 40 to 300% of their body weight in plant material every day.
Wow.
Yeah. So you can contrast this against the other three species of invasive carp, which aren't herbivorous. So black carp is carnivorous, primarily eating mollusks, and silver and bighead carps are filter feeders, consuming zooplankton and phytoplankton mostly. So as with other misguided attempts to fix problems, these guys were actually originally imported to North America for vegetation control.
Oops.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the part that I'm hoping isn't dry. But let's just jump right into reviewing the grass carp taxonomy and some fun facts about each category it falls into. And I'm going to try to make these facts related to evolution, not just like, hey, it's in this group, and they have a dorsal and a ventral, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to try to talk about something interesting in terms of evolution. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's just walk so we can get behind some trees because it is a little breezy here.
Okay.
Did you come across any differences in the mouth of the common carp and grass carp?
I did, but then I didn't jot it down. Do you know?
Yeah, I could just describe it. The common carp's mouth is like kind of telescopic, like some sturgeon like most sturgeon species. It'll extend out and it'll actually suck up food off of the bottom. Grass carp don't really have that. They have like kind of a gummy mouth with it, and it doesn't have the lips that actually like literally extend out in telescopic fashion.
Oh, I see. I also read that different. Its mouth isn't like on the top of its body, and it's not on the bottom of its body. It's like right at the tip of it, of the front of its body.
Yes, and I imagine that's an adaptation for feeding from vegetation on the surface as well as feeding from stuff on the bottom. But the common carp will feed at the surface too, but it's mostly feeding at the bottom. So its mouth, those telescopic lips, are more underneath it.
All right. So I like this segment because, to me, it's like reviewing evolutionary flashcards. So first of all, and we brought this up during one of Daniel's recent episodes, these guys are Actinopterygii,
okay,
or ray-finned fish. So when you think of vertebrates, you should really be thinking of ray-finned fish, because over half of all living vertebrate species are ray-finned fish. Did you guys know that?
No.
I did not.
Yeah.
Wait, half of all vertebrate species?
Yep.
Are ray-finned fish?
Yep.
So we're team lobe-finned fish?
I'll get there. Yeah. So,
already over my head.
So ray-finned fish have lightly built fins made of webbings and skin supporting by radially extended thin bony spines. It's sort of like, just imagine a fish you would draw as a kid. I don't know. Like, it's hard to, lobe-finned fish are a little bit different, but ray-finned, it's like, I think what you would draw maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I ran into that with the salmon episode. I was like, how do you describe this? Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
I only drew Jesus fish as a child. Catholic school.
Yeah. So ray-finned fish are contrasted against their sister group, the Sarcopterygii, or lobe-finned fish, which is what humans are. They have bulkier, fleshy, lobed fins. Other notable lobe-finned fish are coelacanths, lungfish, and seagulls.
Okay. You're going to have to explain this.
Well, it's because all tetrapods are lobe-finned fish.
Is it because fish don't exist?
Phylogenetically. No, I think they exist. They're just a paraphyletic group. So they include non-fish, all of fish include non-fish in their phylogeny.
Okay.
Like it's, so the tetrapods are deeply like in...
What are tetrapods, Steve?
Just four-limbed animals, like mammals, reptiles, birds, you know, everything.
But not everyone may know that.
Yeah. So
we are nested in the what fish?
Lobed finned.
Okay.
Lobe finned fish.
So we've all descended from lobed finned fish. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Daniel, you don't seem sure about that.
No, I'm just thinking about my like great 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 ancestors being a fish.
Yeah.
So there are actually only 8 extant fish-like lobe finned fish, and the remaining 35,000 or more species are tetrapods. So lobe-finned fish are mostly tetrapods, It's just there's a few species that are lobed fish.
Are they, like, older? Was their branching off older or something? Because you talk about the coelacanth and like other, like, other real primitive fish
that
I
know. It's an early branching.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they're just as evolved as anything else. It's just it's early branching. It is a sister group to the ray-finned fish, but yeah.
All right, watch. I'm going to piss Steve off.
Okay.
So those fish that branched off much earlier, they haven't changed at all since then.
Yeah, right? That's true. There we go. So we're just going to... No. No, they you can have, like, what looks like ancestral traits, but you've been evolving just as long as everything else.
I know.
Yeah, I can't imagine... It's hard to think of a... Not hard. It's, like, impossible to imagine a world where you can stop evolution from happening. Okay. So...
Oh, yeah, you can. You just got to be creative enough.
So you won't really hear people talk about lobe-fin fish the way I do. Or, sorry, tetrapods the way I do.
Both.
I just think it's funny to extend the term lobe-fin fish to the whole group, because talking about a seagull as a lobe-fin fish is funny to me.
A what?
A seagull.
A what?
Oh, Steve.
You prick. I know. I used to never say seagull, but now I went over what animal I could say, and seagull, for some reason, sounded the funniest to me. If I said a ring-billed gull, for some reason, I didn't think that that was as funny as saying seagull. I don't know.
Why. You're right. You're right. I'm just trying to fit in with the birding cult. That's all.
Right.
So, folks, most normal people use the term seagull, but if you're a bird snob, there is no species that's actually a seagull. So,
right,
when you're around birders, don't say that word. It's a bad word.
Yeah. It's like a catch-all for many species.
It's like saying Canadian geese.
What if they're from Canada?
That's a huge reside in Canada. Then it's a Canadian
Canada goose.
That's right. A Canadian Canada goose?
Correct.
That sounds a little bit redundant, doesn't it?
Right. Okay. Let's go back to the grass carp, because remember, grass carp aren't lobe-fin fish, they're ray-fin fish. So we're going right back to that.
Gotcha.
Yep. Now, this is a term you probably haven't heard before. So nearly all of ray-finned fish are actually in a group called teleost fish. Are you aware?
Heck no.
No, okay. It's actually somewhere around 96% of all ray-finned fish are teleost fish.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Man, I should have known that then.
Yeah, and I will say, just to give a couple examples of non-teleost ray-finned fish, that would be like sturgeons and gar. They branch off before the teleost group is really established.
That makes sense. They're like the species that have not changed as much as others over time, right?
Okay. The audience knows. The audience knows. So I'm not going to explain each example. I'm just going to throw some bonus info. Like, I'm not going to explain what gars or sturgeon are or whatever. Gotcha. But that's just for people that happen to know a little bit more about fish, which I am not a fish guy, but I'm trying to be one. So I primarily think of teleost fish as the group that underwent a whole genome duplication called the 3R event 320 to 350 million years ago. And this whole genome duplication event is considered one of the most significant in fish evolution. And again, it's shared by most fish species. Now, I know I'm throwing out some terms that most people won't know. But just to kind of like summarize what I've said so far, is just that humans and all other tetrapods are lobe-finned fish. The majority of vertebrate species, just over 50%, are ray-finned fish, which make up nearly 100% of all fish. Most ray-finned fish are teleost fish, and the evolution of teleost fish was underpinned by a whole genome duplication event in the ancestor of all teleost fish. So a genome duplication is going to be important for some of what we'll talk about later, just in terms of their management, just in terms of the grass carp's management. So I'll just try to explain that kind of simply now. I'll try. Now, Bill, you're going to be a really good audience to see if I pull this off or not. First, you have two complete copies of your genome within every cell of your body. Have you ever heard of 23andMe?
Sure.
So that's referring to the fact that the human genome has 23 pairs of chromosomes, which makes up your entire diploid genome. So if you had one set of 23 chromosomes, that would be a haploid genome. And that would be things that are in that would be like the type of genome that like a sperm or an egg cell has. So typically all your cells are diploid. They have 23 pairs of chromosomes, but in sperm and egg cells, they're haploid. They only have one set of 23 chromosomes. And those eventually unite to form a diploid organism during sexual reproduction.
Am I getting the talk?
Oh, it's time, Daniel.
So this isn't unnecessary detail. because you can't really talk about grass carp without talking about diploid and triploid fish, triploid being a genome with three copies of each chromosome. Okay? That's going to become really important later.
Which humans typically don't have.
Yeah. Humans will just have diploid.
Okay.
Yeah, they're just going to be diploid. So chromosomes, a word that I've been using, is just made of DNA. In biology, we all know that genetic information flows from DNA to RNA to proteins. Really, it's a specific sequence of DNA called genes that are then transcribed into RNA, and then the RNA is translated into proteins. Okay?
Okay. I'm with you so far.
Yeah. So now let's imagine an organism that only has 30,000 genes, which is actually pretty close to what many organisms have. In your entire genome, the 3.2 billion bases, we just have about 30,000 genes. That's roughly true. Now, let's imagine that all 30,000 of those genes are absolutely necessary for the organism's growth, development, and reproduction. So in this imaginary scenario, none of these genes can accumulate mutations without being deadly.
Oh.
Like, this is just a made-up scenario. This usually is not the case. Like, if you get a mutation in this gene, the organism won't even develop, you know? So now, imagine that the entire genome doubles through some mistake during reproduction. Suddenly, we have a redundant copy of all 30,000 genes in the genome that can now accumulate mutations in at least one copy while still preserving that original copy and its original function.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah. So while whole genome duplications don't provide new variation, it does provide gene redundancy for evolution to then act on.
So it makes it, I kind of remember talking about this when we talked about the rattlesnake venom. So it makes it have a higher ability or potential for evolving and mutating, but not detrimentally.
Yes. So I will say typically whole genome duplications are bad. They usually don't lead to like anything good. They usually just the organism won't develop, or it'll die off, or it'll be it won't be fertile or whatever.
Okay.
But every now and then something happens where it survives and it's able to continue on with all this extra genetic material that it can accumulate mutations in. And I will say, for the most part, most genes that are redundant will accumulate mutations and become non-functional. But some will develop sub-functions of the original gene, and some will develop new functions. But those are much more rare. Most genes will accumulate mutations and become non-functional. And if they accumulate enough mutations, we won't even be able to recognize them as once being genes. Like, eventually they disappear. They
become too... It's mutated so much, yeah.
So what does it turn into when it's no longer a gene?
It starts as something called a pseudogene.
Okay.
Which is like, you can tell that it used to be a gene, but now it's missing its start promoter, or it's missing something vital that it's just not going to be expressed like a typical gene would. But then eventually, pseudogenes build up mutations, and then they basically disappear, and no one can tell that they were ever there.
Why are you encouraging him? Just shut up, dude.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay. So one way to think about how important whole genome duplications have been to evolution is to consider that the ancestors of all vertebrates went through two rounds of whole genome duplication. These are actually called the 1R and 2R events. And look how numerous and diverse their descendants are.
Hmm.
Right?
So say that again. Who went through those?
So all the ancestor of all vertebrates has underwent two rounds of whole genome duplication. And we could see, you know, there's so many descendants of that ancestor, and they're so variable, you know. And again, the ancestor of virtually all fish underwent an additional teleost specific whole genome duplication, or 3R whole genome duplication event, and look at how numerous and diverse they are, making up about half of vertebrates. So you have all vertebrates having two rounds of whole genome duplication in the ancestor, and then half of all vertebrates having another whole genome duplication in their ancestor. Yeah. So you could tell that there's something about whole genome duplication that if it's able to continue on in the population, then it'll lead to diversity and, you know, it's not the only way to get diversity, but it is one of the mechanisms for diversity.
And as you're talking about this, I'm first time I'm hearing this kind of stuff, but the question that comes in my head, because you were saying, typically if this happens, the genome duplication, the organism isn't successful.
Yeah. Like, almost every single time. It's not good.
And part of me, after you said that, you know, this happened twice to all vertebrates and then once again to the teleosts. Part of me is like, oh, well, it's happened a few times, but three times is like essentially nothing.
Right.
In terms of evolutionary history. Like, it is a minuscule, tiny, 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 tiny drop in the bucket of the potential of times it could have happened.
Yes.
Yeah. So when you talk about that happening three times, is that like it happened within a population over a long period of time? Or is this something...
Did it happen in one generation?
Any knowledge of that? Like, when you talk about the full genome duplication, like, is that a fast process or is it something that takes a long time?
It's a singular event.
Okay.
But it's complicated. So I can't give a really good answer.
Okay. That's all right.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. All right.
Also, this is something that's way more common in plants. There are some species that since the split of the rosids and asterids about 100 to 120 million years ago, they've underwent like 4 whole genome duplications since then.
Wow.
Yeah. So it just happens a lot more in plants.
That's why plants are so much more awesome than animals, right?
Yeah.
Daniel?
Sure.
But I will say, whole genome duplications aren't everything, because species like coffee make some really crazy cool compounds, and they haven't gone through any whole genome duplications since there was a triplication event actually near the base of the asterid rosid split. So they haven't gone through anything since then, and they have some pretty amazing compounds. So it's not everything, this duplication stuff. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, so with that lecture over, let's get back to the grass carp shit. So they're in the Cypriniforms order, meaning that they're related to other carps and minnows, but also groups like loaches, suckers, danios, and others that I'm just going to skip. So they belong to the Xenocyprinidae, which basically means foreign carps, which is a family of Asian carps. So the grass carp is actually the only member of its genus, and I want you to try to say that.
Tenopharyngodon.
Tenopharyngodon.
Actually, you guys did a good job. I've struggled with this word, and I think you guys did it way better than I did the first time. But that's more or less how I would say it. Tenopharyngodon.
Yeah.
But it doesn't roll off the tongue.
It does not.
You know? No. So, so I'm just going to call it, well, you either call it Tenopharyngodon idella, or C. idella, or skip all of that and just call it the grass carp.
Right.
Because grass carp is just way
better. Let's go with common name for this one.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so let's move on to their history. So in 1963, grass carp were first imported into Stuttgart, Arkansas. Sounds like a German city.
It does.
Yeah.
That's what I thought you were going to say first. I was like, what?
we're in Germany now.
Stuttgart, Arkansas.
Another field trip episode.
Yeah. And they were introduced as a biological control for problematic aquatic weeds. And at the time, for environmental and political reasons, people were looking at biological controls as a replacement for the broad use of chemicals. And grass carp was actually promoted by federal and state agencies and universities for about 10 years.
So this was probably, what, 60s?
Yeah, 63.
Yeah, yep. There you go.
The first accidental release was in 1966, so only 3 years later.
Didn't take us long to mess things up, huh?
Yeah. By 1972, grass carp were stocked in open water systems, documented in at least 16 states, and established in the Mississippi River system. From 1972 to 1985, public agencies researched and eventually produced, in conjunction with the private sector, non-reproductive triploid grass carp.
Why? Just so they wouldn't reproduce?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's scary to release stuff, you know, from Asia into into the U.S.
So you can continue to use it as a biological control of plants and aquatic systems without them being able to reproduce and spread around.
Exactly.
In theory.
Yes. So
I'm glad you added
diploid
that.
Grass carp can reproduce, and triploid grass carp cannot reproduce. And this seems a little late based on the fact that diploid fish were already escaped before this point.
Yeah, that's why I asked. Like, yeah. Okay.
So I'll just say how triploid grass carp are created. They're actually created by shocking fertilized eggs with a sudden change in pressure or temperature. And normally there's a small cell called a polar body that has a set of chromosomes that's not needed by the egg during fertilization. But the shock stops the polar body from being expelled from the egg. So now it has this extra set of chromosomes, making it a triploid. So now instead of there being just one set from the sperm, one set from the egg, now it's one from the sperm, one from the egg, and one from the polar body that's typically expelled.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, and I'll just say why it's sterile. So all we've said is triple eight equals sterile. But the mechanism for why it's sterile is just like, unlike when there's two sets of chromosomes, the three sets of chromosomes can't align and separate properly during meiosis, which is the generation of sperm and egg cells. And that's as far as I'm going to go with it, is that they just can't align and separate properly when there's three copies. When there's two copies, everything comes together very nicely, separates into the two.
Is that why thruples don't work like couples do?
Oh, they work, Daniel. Speak for yourself.
Nature abhors odd numbers.
There's
a joke about your mom in there somewhere.
You leave my mom out of this.
Cut that out, please.
So by 1985, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's official biological opinion was that triple-eight grass carp were an environmentally safe, weed-controlling fish. I guess they also taste good, but have a lot of small bones. That was in the report for some reason that I read.
I've never eaten it. Crap. Carp are really looked down upon eating, usually over in the West, or at least around the United States. But I know that some people eat them and enjoy them. But I also know it's farmed pretty heavily as a big food source out in the East.
Well, so. I saw a Taiwan news story where a well-known grass carp farmer that's known for having delicious carp, they actually feed their carp fava beans, which apparently makes it taste a lot better. Oh. So if you guys have your own grass carp at home, feed it fava beans.
I mean, it makes sense. You wouldn't want to eat a common carp that's eating muck and sludge and stuff at the bottom of our polluted waterways here, but something like that sounds a lot better than grass carp.
So you said they're looked down upon. Is that a justified thing? Do they not taste as good as other species?
Well, I know this more so with the common carp. They are considered a trash fish mostly. I grew up fishing for them and catching them. So when I discovered grass carp was a thing and they're even bigger, I was super excited. But they're looked upon as, a bottom feeder, not a game fish. They're mucky, they're slimy. They don't taste good if you eat them.
Okay.
But over in the UK, that's their number one sport fish.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's pretty different perspectives around the world.
Well, British food is pretty gross.
So I was watching a YouTube video and some guy caught a common carp. I wasn't going to bring it up because it wasn't a grass carp, but he was like, let's just see how it tastes. And he cooked it up. He's like, it's kind of fatty, whatever. And then as he was eating it, he's like, this isn't the worst thing I've ever eaten. And it's not the worst fish that I've ever had, but it's really strong flavor. It's it's not muddy or it's not fishy or whatever. He's like, and also I think it kind of tastes like the water. And I caught it out of a really dirty pond. But he wasn't saying it was bad. And I don't know. And it even smells a little weird at the pond,
Well, consider where you're catching it from. That's important, too.
Oh, and also the small bone thing came up in that video I watched. I know that's common carp, but as he was eating it, he's like, oh, yep. And he picked out this tiny little bone,
Man.
And they're so similar
that
I assume it's probably true for both of them. So since 1985, for the next 30 years, 7 million certified triploid grass carp were shipped throughout the U.S. And I don't actually totally understand why, so maybe you guys might have an idea. But in some states, it was illegal to stock diploid fish. But in others, such as Alaska, Oregon, Montana, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Massachusetts, Vermont, Maine, Maryland, and Rhode Island, you were allowed to stock both diploid and triploid fish.
I
gave the whole list in case any of it helped.
When you were first going through the states, my hypothesis was maybe the climate is so cold there they won't be able to reproduce. But then you started listing ones at our latitude, and I was I don't know why. That just sounds irresponsible to me. But
right, I'm just thinking I'm thinking of the way water flows, and I'm like, they can get into the Great Lakes from those states, right?
Yeah, they can. Yeah,
depending on where they're at, Minnesota touches Lake Superior.
So I know people are most worried about Lake Erie because it's the shallowest and it has the most wetland, and it has the most wetland habitats. It's the most diverse of the Great Lakes. But I think all of the Great Lakes are obviously there is some fear for all of them, but Lake Erie especially. I think you wouldn't want those collapsing, which we will talk about a little bit.
All right, well, we'll try to find an answer to that
put it
in the episode notes if we can.
Yeah, but who cares anyway, even if we don't find an answer. So as long as the diploid grass carp aren't in the Great Lakes, it's fine.
Great Lakes.
Yeah.
Steve said just kidding.
Okay. Other waterways are obviously important too. So apparently there's no U.S. state or Canadian province in the Great Lakes Basin that allows the stocking of fertile diploid grass carp. But illegal importation of diploid grass carp into the basin has been documented. So we know it's happening. It's just you can't do it legally.
Why would people be doing that, though?
I don't know.
It's I imagine it's for...
Sport fishing?
No, aquatic control or vegetation control in their ponds.
Okay.
And they just, they don't think about the repercussions if it escapes. Or they go, you know, oh, my pond is, you know, away from any other body of water. It's in the middle of my farm, something like that. But as Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park says, life finds a way.
Yeah, and I guess as of 2011, we have had the first evidence of grass carp naturally reproducing in the Great Lakes Basin. And how they do this is they catch carp, and then they check their ploidy levels. It's actually kind of cool how ploidy is done. So you isolate a cell from the specimen. You treat it with some kind of fluorescent dye that only binds to DNA. You shine a laser on the cell, and then you record the emitted fluorescence. And the more fluorescence, the more DNA in a cell. So you have a known fluorescent peak for diploids, a known peak for triploids, and so on. So if a diploid fluorescence measures at 100, you should expect the triploid peak at 150, and that's what they did. Yeah, because you know the more labeled DNA, the more fluorescent it's gonna be.
Gotcha.
So I mentioned earlier that grass carp can consume 40% to 300% of their body weight in plant material every day. So apparently, this produces a lot of waste, which can lead to algal blooms that negatively impact water quality, typically depleting them of oxygen, which also does pose a threat to human health and safety with fish dying and things like that. So, if they're rapidly eating vegetation in the Great Lakes wetlands, especially in Lake Erie, which I sort of mentioned earlier, which also is a very suitable habitat for Asian carps in general, because it's shallow, has a lot of wetland habitats, well, that damages important habitats for native fishes and birds, which would also negatively impact commercial and recreational activities, such as fishing and bird watching, and not just in the Great Lakes, but in the rivers and tributaries that are attached to the Great Lakes. So this threat is a huge concern to the U.S. and Canada because of how important the Great Lakes ecosystem is. So all four invasive carps are on the level of zebra mussels and sea lamprey.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So so there's a lot of efforts to block their spread with physical barriers, including like electrified ones, sound deterrents to block underwater movement, early detection, as well as capture, removal, and ploidy screenings of the invaders before they can establish populations, as well as public outreach and developing new management tools for targeting only invasive carp. So that's all I have for that. I have one final little section, just for my own benefit, more or less.
Okay.
So typically I end with the stuff about their invasiveness or whatever. But lastly, I just want to go over some discoveries involving the published genomes of grass carp. So because grass carp are an important farmed fish, accounting for about 16% of global freshwater agriculture, or aquaculture, I should say.
16%?
Yeah, 16%. A male and female genome were published in 2015 by Wang et al. Both specimen were from China and sequenced to aid in breeding practices. They weren't great genome assemblies by today's standards, but that doesn't mean they're not useful. So even an incomplete genome assembly can help you solve evolutionary mysteries. So grass carp actually completely transition from a carnivorous to an herbivorous diet when they become 3 to 5.5 centimeters in body length. So that's around 1.5 months after hatching. How this is achieved is something that you can only really get from gene expression within the genome. So what they saw is they saw significant changes in gene expression. And actually it was a 32-fold increase in the mevalonate, we're not going to talk about this too much, mevalonate pathway and steroid biosynthesis in liver tissues, which are important for breaking down and digesting plant material instead of animal material.
That would make sense.
That's cool.
So steroid hormones also help regulate the metabolism of carbohydrates, proteins, and fats, which are essential for adapting to a plant-based diet.
I wonder if amphibians go through a similar thing when they transition from, you know.
I would imagine so. I mean, it's obviously it's a whole new, you know, set of metabolites.
Yeah.
So they also determined that grass carp has a chromosomal fusion, which may have led to differences in body size and sex determination, but they didn't really focus on it too much. So more excitedly, though, a second Chinese grass carp genome assembly was published in 2022 by Wu et al., and it's a much better genome assembly. They actually found very similar results to the previous paper, but they also found that many conserved non-coding regions, so regions of the genome that don't become RNA or protein or anything, these regions of the genome that are conserved but aren't genes, these are typically what's called promoters or enhancers or repressors, meaning that they'll either make it so genes are expressed less or expressed more, you know. They found that these regions, these conserved non-coding regions, were lost around genes that were important for digestive system development, which may also have had an important role in the switch to herbivory. It's probably no mistake that this is around the development of the digestive system.
Sure. The yeah. change in the diet, yeah.
Okay. So, and that's it. All right? So that's all I have for this episode. There is way more to cover, but there's only so much time in an episode. And I did mention earlier that I do research on grass carp at the top of the show. So maybe when we're published, we can do a second episode, kind of a follow-up one, to kind of cover a bunch of the stuff I had to skip. I pretty much skipped everything that I care about, but it was still fun to read into all, you know, a lot of their ecology and phylogeny and all that other stuff.
And it was fun to have you do an episode.
For once. And my phone didn't die as the episode was going.
I wanted to mention, too, that I wanted to mention it, but then you got going on your roll there when you talked about the, like, physical barriers preventing the different carp from moving up. I saw it was some kind of nature documentary. They were at these electrical barriers that were hopefully preventing the bighead and silver carp from traveling up north, and that they have some that are, like, literally the last barrier that'll prevent them from getting into Lake Michigan. And they, I can't remember what the device was called or exactly how it worked, but they would drive a boat above the dam somewhere and they would literally test the water. And they said for, in like a pretty sizable area, it would pick up any remaining genetics from any carp that was in the area.
Is that?
It would be able to tell you if it was there or not.
Oh, the eDNA.
eDNA.
Yeah.
Okay.
eDNA is huge for detection without ever end up having to catch an organism at all.
Yes. That's environmental DNA.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I think they're using it for pythons too, down south.
Yeah.
But I remember something about that.
Yeah, but I remember hearing about it for the bighead and silver carp.
So eDNA is a really important tool. So yeah.
So Steve, did you say I thought you said they were in the Great Lakes Basin, or they weren't?
They are. I mean, that's where we catch them, is in the Great Lakes. But in terms of diploid individuals, supposedly there are some diploid individuals. There was one paper from, did I say 2011?
I don't remember.
I think it was a 2011 paper that was like the first indication that there was diploid individuals in the Great Lakes.
Okay.
Gotcha.
That we knew for sure. That.
And what you were just talking about, Daniel, with those barriers. So that wasn't for grass carp. That was for other carp?
That was for the bighead and silver carp. When people think about Asian carp and they think about the like big problem and all the fish jumping, like the two primary species of the Asian carp, is for as far as what people are meaning, are bighead and silver.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, but grass carp, so they're not like a huge problem in the Great Lakes right now, right?
They would be if they were established.
Gotcha. Yeah. So they just...
Could be.
I guess we'll just see if they're gone or not.
They probably
so,
will
Steve,
be.
Steve, I'm relying on you to stop them.
Right, yeah.
All right. Cool. So thank you, Steve.
Yeah.
And I think now it's time for our big announcement.
Oh, yeah.
Our bittersweet announcement.
Bittersweet announcement is right. I will be leaving the field guides, and as far as the role that I play now, I accepted a job in South Florida, so far away, with the Tropical Audubon Society. So I'll be moving at the end of this week. So this is my last episode as a regular field guides podcaster, but I'm hoping that we can continue to have me on in the future occasionally as a guest, and even
you can invite yourself to even continue.
I'm putting you on the spot on the episode, so maybe you'll let me in. Or
we
ideally
sign contracts right now.
Yeah, I get like one a year when I come home and visit family. Yeah. Or ideally continue the Everglades series and have Bill and Steve come down and visit me, and then we can continue that there. But I want to say a huge thank you to Steve, a huge thank you to Bill for having me join them. It's been so much fun. I've learned a lot from doing research for the episodes, from hearing Bill and Steve talk about their topics as well, and it's been a lot of fun with two people who are very close friends of mine. So thank you for that.
Our pleasure.
Yeah, it was. So Bill knew you more before we started together, but I feel like it's only been super good having you on.
Yeah.
And also, like I said before, you're a really, really good speaker.
Thank you.
You talk flawlessly, so no edits needed. You're not an awkward person like me. So.
Oh, yeah. Stop.
One thing I've come to realize, you know, getting older, I'm the oldest one here, is that very often when things are going well in a situation in your life, it's important to stop and be grateful that you're going through that, because it's not going to last, chances are. And I was very glad that when you told us that you were leaving, I was just glad that we took time in the last episode to acknowledge what you've done for the podcast this past year, because it's been awesome having you. I felt so grateful that you were willing to give your time, your expertise, your talents to the podcast, and we're going to miss you.
I'm going to miss you guys too. Boom. Thank you, Bill.
We are so happy for you.
Yeah. It's a good problem to have, you know, for having to leave a podcast for a good job. So
yeah. And we expect to see you as the official Florida man making headlines down there in Florida.
I'll do my best. Yeah.
And hopefully we'll be down there in Januarys to come.
Yeah.
Like we have the past 2 years.
I think you got that dog in you, man. You can be a Florida man.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll fit right in.
All right, folks. So it is time for our wrap-up. And we want to start the wrap-up by mentioning the Sparkbird Project. So the Sparkbird Project, it's an ongoing community science initiative, and it's designed to gather, share, and study the stories of people's passion for birds. So you guys know what a Sparkbird is, right?
No.
Yeah.
So, Daniel, what is it?
So a Sparkbird is the bird that you encounter that gets you into birding.
Oh.
It's your first notable bird sighting. Sometimes it's like the first bird you see when you go birding, but usually it happens because you're not a birder yet. It's what gets you into the hobby. It's what gets you into it and gets you involved.
So. Right.
Do you want to know? I sort of have two.
That's and not how it works, Steve.
No, they're embarrassing. One was... my whole life, I heard Blue Jays all over the place, but it wasn't until like I was like in my fourth year of college that I finally saw one. And I'm sure that I saw them before, but they just were like, they like zoomed past.
You had bird blindness.
Yeah, right? I didn't have the filter for it.
Yeah.
And the other one was pileated woodpeckers. Even though I heard them all the time and I saw them flying every now and then, it took me a long time to actually see one like perched on a tree, like doing its thing like up close. Huh. It took me a long time to get those two, and those are two pretty common birds in our area.
Well, usually they are, you know, because it's something, the person's not a birder yet, so it's not like they're like seeking out a super rare bird.
Yeah.
Mine was a common merganser, because I was about to go do a birding class for field ecology with Sandy, who we mentioned before. He's a instructor at the University of Buffalo, and I just kind of wanted to get ahead of the class a little bit, so I took the field guide that I had and I went out to the creek near my house, and I saw a bird, and I used the field guide to identify it, and I identified it as a common merganser, and I thought it was so cool. It was like a puzzle trying to figure out what it was, and that got me into it. But before that, didn't think about them, didn't pay attention to them. So
it was a seagull.
Dang.
So I always told people I didn't have a spark bird. I was not a birder for a long, long time. Even when I started working for Buffalo Audubon, I wasn't a birder. And they brought me on for that reason, because the director at the time was a big birder. He wanted to balance out the staff. But my first day on site, I was living there, someone knocked on our door my first morning there and said, "Where is the yellow-headed blackbird?" And I had no idea what they were talking about.
Right.
Apparently, one had been sighted. And this is a southern bird. We don't see it in western New York.
Yeah.
And for the next 3 or 4 days, people would be knocking on my door, coming into the center, looking for this bird. They wanted to see it. And that was really my first glimpse of the birding community. I didn't even have an idea that there were people that would go out looking specifically for birds. And that they didn't, a lot of them aren't and they're just interested in other stuff. They're just super interested in birds.
Yeah.
You know,
I wonder if mine are really spark birds or not, or if they're the ones where they're just good memories that stand out. Like, because I have the same thing when I was in Utah with the clay-colored sparrow, and when I was at Tift hiking alone when I saw my first black tern, and I'm like, what is that? You know, and it was before I ever went out with Tom or anything, you know.
It's not always clear-cut. I used to think maybe mine was, when I was a kid, I had my first encounter with a great horned owl. It was, I guess it was injured because it was on the ground. And I thought it was so cool that I was seeing an owl up close. So I've often considered that my spark bird, but I wasn't a birder after that. I was like, oh, cool, look, an owl. And then I went back to, you know, doing kids' non-related bird stuff for over a decade.
You're just
an
owl lover.
So,
you know, I saw that golden ring and, what is it, blue wing hybrid?
Yes.
I saw that, and that's not even in my list. Like, even though that was really cool to be out and see, you don't choose the memories that stick out. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, it was just a cool. That's cool that I saw it. You know, but it's not one of the stories. But.
So, folks, the reason we're talking about this though is the Sparkbird Project. It's led by our friend and longtime supporter of the podcast, Jen Lodi Smith, In this project, it combines her passion for nature and her expertise in personality science. So if you want to find out more about it, if you want to read some SparkBird stories, and even if you have one, share your SparkBird story, you can go to www.spark-bird.org. And the research findings of people sharing their stories, they go directly back to community partners of the project and inform their efforts toward inclusively sparking and sustaining other birders. But the big reason we're mentioning this now is because there is now, did you notice, Daniel, a SparkBird podcast?
Yes. Yeah.
So it just came out early February 2025. Each episode, you can listen in as Jen and her co-host, poet and author Janet Pendali, they interview a naturalist, an author, or some other talented person about their SparkBird and why you're a loser if you're not a birder.
You're not on this podcast yet, are you? Have you been
no,
on it? Okay, because I was like, you said talented person, you know, pretty strongly.
No, so. That's why I haven't been on
it. Oh,
and okay. I probably won't be on the podcast. All right.
Wow, that's kind of shocking.
So,
and she's one of our patrons.
She is.
I'm just kidding. I know Jen.
All right. So, Daniel, why don't you start our official wrap-up here?
Sure. So first and foremost, we'd like to thank our growing list of Patreon supporters. So thank you to our new patrons, Michaela G. We also like to give a special shout out each month to our top patrons. So stick around for the end of the episode to hear Bill's daughter, Violet, share that list. And if you'd like to support the podcast, consider becoming a patron of our show at patreon.com. As a patron, you'll get access to a special patrons-only version of our episodes that include Bill sharing the episode notes. Because of our support from our listeners, we've been able to keep the show free and make cooler episodes like our recent Florida-based episode on American crocodiles. Or you can make a one-time donation through PayPal on our website. A big thank you to Old Man Running for his generous donation last month. Thank you, sir, for all you've done, for all the kids you've worked with, and for all the great work you're helping bring to fruition at the Western New York Land Conservancy.
I know who Old Man Running is. He's a friend. So. And don't forget that we have Field Guides merch available through our website store at thefieldguidespodcast.com.
And remember, if you can't financially support the podcast, you can help out by sharing it with friends and family and by subscribing and leaving us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps spread the word and allows us to reach a wider audience. We'd like to thank our newest iTunes reviewers, Julie on the Gram.
And I just wanted to put in, folks, I liked what she said about in her comment, about us in her comment. So go ahead, Steve.
So she said, our show is the kind of natural fun you'd feel sitting around a table with Bill, Daniel, and Steve sharing a cup of coffee and a few laughs. I like that.
No, she said a few laughs. Just a few.
I think I know who this Julie is. Oh, she's a wonderful person. Yeah,
all right.
I believe I do.
And also thanks to Betty B., who's on Podbean and commented that she's a volunteer at GSMNP.
Great Smoky Mountains National Park.
Oh, got it. And we help her provide info to her visitors.
That's right.
Wow.
All right, and Danny, you got to read this last part.
Come enjoy our sporadic posts on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky, and you can always email us ideas for episode topics, criticisms, or your stories of personal encounters with deserters like Daniel.
Oh, no.
You guys did me dirty. At thefieldguides@gmail.com.
And parents, remember to get those kids outside. Let them get muddy. Let them get dirty. Let them flip over rocks and logs.
Get them to the Everglades.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And if you don't have kids, please make sure to make some time to get yourself outside. And Steve and I will see you next time.
Yeah.
And hopefully Daniel will see you somewhere down the trail.
Hopefully.
And now let's just say to each other what we've always wanted to say to each other while we have Daniel on the mic. 3, 2, 1, I love you.
I love you.
I thought you guys were going to say it, too.
I was going to say it, too.
Imagine if it actually worked out that way. All right. See you next time, guys.
See you, folks.
Bye, everyone.
We should mention it at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, mention
it. Say what
it
is until the end.
Oh.
Build suspense.
Okay.
So we have a big announcement at the end of the episode.
Gotcha. Oh.
Yeah, but people might think it's a good... Attention. Well, people might think it's a good thing. It is sort of a good thing.
Well, the Daniel haters will think it's a good thing.
We'll say it's a good and bad thing, right?
Okay. Can we say that it involves Daniel?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
He's dying.
He's dying.
Well, what's good about that? Yeah. Okay, are we ready?
Yeah.
Yeah, jeez.
And here's Violet with this episode's top patrons.
Eric, Alyssa, Adam, Mary, Dr. Judy, Kimberly B., Peter R., Callie, Rich K., The Hebranks, Orange Julianne, Daniel M., Diane, we named the dog Indy, Hot Dog Cold Weather, Dwayne H., Jennifer D., Jonathan A., Val, Andy W., Elizabeth P., Picasso 3, John R., Evan, Mark T., Cecilia, Julie B., Dennis, Chris N., Sung, Jeff S., Colin G., Jonathan K., Matt E., Plants in My Pants, Sean M., Ryan R., Sophie S., Connor H., Measure and Principle, Fragaria Papilloinoidea, Outside Chronicles, Andrew C., Quixote, Matt D., Melissa Marie Industrie Z., Kelly S., Sarah S., Helen A., Judy F., Ben C., Jane H., DoodleDude82, Galen Mac, Kazis, Esther C., John W., Mark V., Bethany H., Rob M.
Well done.
Whew. That's a lot of patrons.
Patrons, on behalf of Daniel, Steve, and myself, thank you all so much for your support. I know over the past year, Daniel has been impressed by how much support we've received from you and the rest of our patrons, and Steve and I promise to continue to try to live up to your support. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time. Thank you, Violet.
Goodbye.